does it mean to be a good citizen in 2017? What does doing citizenship look like? Is it voting, paying taxes, serving in the military, protesting injustice or resisting overreaching authority? Is it volunteering in your neighborhood school or some form of national service or running for office? I'm Paul Lazar, and for the past few weeks we've been sharing stories of civic engagement on WVIA. Tuesday night, NPR comes to the Royal Theater at the University of Scranton for an evening of conversation and performance to ask, what does it mean to be a good citizen? It's a live video stream panel discussion featuring nationally known commentators as well as regional residents with local stories of civic engagement and good citizenship. The host is Michelle Martin, host of Weekend All Things Considered. You're invited to join the conversation at 7 p.m. Tuesday evening. Tickets are available online at nprevents.org. There's also a very easy link on our website, wvia.org. In preparation for this event, WVIA has been showcasing regional stories of civic engagement, citizenship in action. On today's program, Lori McCants and Gerard Stropnicki of the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble speak with WVIA's Erica Funke about the piece they'll be presenting at the event, Letters to the Editor, and about the importance of theater in the community.
BTE was commissioned by the town of Berwick. They had a bicentennial commission. They were creating they're celebrating their 200 years. This is like 1987. That's an old town, right? So going back to 1787. Mm-hmm. And working with Lee Strimbeck primarily, she and I wrote and directed this piece that was all based on found materials. It was all letters and diaries and newspaper advertising and speeches and things. We recreate deeds. We performed all that with a community and professional cast. And it was huge and it was ungainly and it was a wonderful mess. But it was wonderful in its way. And in that, we found letters that we performed some of, but we started to build a file of these letters we didn't use. And it was like, wow, there's something really rich here. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a grant to the National Endowment for the Arts, without which none of this happens. That's a bit of citizenship, folks. Without the National Endowment for the Arts, none of this happens. And you think, oh, well, they're just giving to the big fancy people. No, that's not the point.
Most of it goes to rural areas.
Right. It is about finding these
rural
voices.
Or high poverty areas in need.
So they gave us something like $5,000 in 1991. It was not a big grant, but it was enough that I could say to the company, can I work on this for a while? And then we made some workshops, and my working on it meant getting rolls of dimes and giving them to the actors who joined the process, and we'd go up to the library and look for letters about dogs or letters about whatever across history and began to build files and to play with them as performance texts. And we started to workshop it pretty quickly. There was support, and it took until 1996 to make the whole piece work. And then, wow, it was big, you know. For us, it got a lot of attention. It was written about everywhere. NPR did a big piece on mm-hmm. it with Scott Simon that was recorded right here in this room. Mm-hmm. And then VIA did a television version of it that was broadcast many times. Mm-hmm. And they came and taped it live. You know, it was a live remote that they did. Boy, those were the days. And you can't do that without the Corporation of Public Broadcasting or the National Endowment for the Arts. And then it toured nationally and off the NPR Scott Simon thing on Weekend Edition. We got a call from an agent who had talked to an editor. And they wanted to make a book, and it became a book by, it was published by Simon & Schuster in 1998. It's almost 20 years ago. And so, you know, but it is hundreds of letters covering two centuries of life in along this river, primarily Bloomsburg, but not entirely. Mm-hmm. It goes from Wilkes-Barre to Sunbury mm-hmm. to Harrisburg.
And what do we learn about our humanity and what interests us and what we want to sound off about and why do we value this kind of forum?
Well, as my dad used to like to say, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, it is astonishing how the concerns of citizens remain the same from the time of even before the founding of this experimental nation that we have. And given the opportunity to speak our opinions, which we have, because it is our right, it's astonishing to see that the concerns are still the same. There's concern about the fate of the nation. There's concern about neighbors. There's concern about how we treat our children. There's concern about how we treat our old folks. There's concern about the state of the roads. Too many potholes. health. Jerry, what
will the neighbor's house get painted?
Yeah.
So some of it is like real local. There's also concern about our place in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
There's also concern about our place as spiritual beings and our relationships to God. That shows up again and again. There are concerns about the macro political world. There's a chapter in the book that is insults to every president ever. Of course, the book was published in 98, so it ends with Bill Clinton. But, you know, it would have continued. nothing changes. But also what's really cool, I think, is the humanity of the voices.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the people here are struggling, as you and I do every day, with what it means to be a citizen. What does that mean? How do we participate? What is our job? You know, we think of letters to the editor largely as screaming, complaining, and there's a fair share of that. But one of the things about a small town is they print every word. And so... pretty much. And so you get real native voice happening. These texts are, we found very quickly, are rich and alive with the sound of this place. And we may not agree with what the person may be saying politically, or we may see a different answer to that particular question. But the way they express themselves is an expression of soul and of heart. And it's quite beautiful. It's very deeply human.
Yeah, there's a lot of hate, but there's also a lot of love, a lot of love, and that's encouraging.
Just from a position of presenting it on stage, what are the considerations that a playwright might consider in terms of rhythm and variety of voices and mm-hmm. so forth?
Boy, it's a hard thing to think about, because these days I do a lot of work around the country in communities in stress off their stories. And that question doesn't change from project to project, whether I'm working in Kentucky or Georgia or California or Uganda. Wherever I'm working, those questions come up in terms of what those rhythms are. And it ends up exposing something about me and my own taste. You know, if I'm the person doing the adapting, or I'm the person doing the directing, I'm going to find rhythms that appeal. And it's not invented. I mean, it ends up underneath each of these pieces, and certainly underneath Letters, is the structure of a well-made play. It has a rising action and introduction of characters. It has a large dollop of humor. You don't start off with something that's going to slap you in the face. If you're going to get to really hard topics, which you always do,
mm-hmm.
always do,
mm-hmm.
they come later in the piece when you've earned it.
Mm-hmm.
They are surrounded and lifted and given what they need, which includes humor and comic relief. And then it ends in a place of hope. I think one of the most important things is I am not big on transgression for this sense of transgression. In my work in community and in Letters being one of the early key pieces, it isn't about I'm smarter, we're smarter than anybody else as the performers. It isn't about how shocking this is and let's leave the audience shocked. I don't much like that, actually. That's not where I come from. I am about allowing the shock, certainly, and not preaching an answer, but showing a door that lets us through somehow, whatever that door is. And in these pieces that are collages built of many, many voices, sometimes it can be a complete switch to another voice of, you know, so if we're looking at some of the hardest community issues you can look at, the next thing might be an innocent voice that reminds us that that's also part of our world. So it isn't, these things aren't designed. Joe Carson would always talk about there needing to be a door out. You need a door out. If you're going to go to the dark places, you cannot leave a community to do that in that place. If you leave them in the dark place, you are creating damage. And the work that we do as artists is extraordinarily powerful. And if we create damage and leave people in a damaged state, our citizenship is horrible.
The best example of that is the ending of our play version of Letters to the Editor, which was also the epilogue in the book that came out of the play. We took the audience to some difficult places in the second act of Letters to the Editor, having to do with real hatred in our town and having to do with real disappointments in hopes for a town spirit that didn't arise when it needed to arise, etc. That was balanced with humorous stuff as well. But the second act took us to some difficult places. Mm-hmm. The final letter that was presented had to do with a child, a young boy talking about how disappointed he thought life in a small town would be friendlier, and it wasn't as friendly as he had expected. And then there was a coda of many of the characters' names and little snippets of their letters that we've gotten to know through the course of the piece. And then there was the applause. And then I got to perform this in one of the iterations. Jerry had staged the play with, we just used a lot of chairs in different configurations. And, you know, chairs representing all kinds of, like, levels of economic wealth or not wealth, place, etc. So chairs were the main scenic element. Well, for this epilogue, I brought out a folding lawn chair and set it up and sat down in it and looked out to the audience. And I can read this to you. Dear sir, I'm writing this to thank the Bloomsburg Police Department for bringing back my lawn chair to me. I did not report it stolen, being that it was not a very expensive chair, but it made me feel good that they took the time to find the owner of the chair. Where they found it, I do not know, but I feel very thankful to them. Mrs. John Moyle, Bloomsburg. And I always choked up when delivering that letter, because I was sitting in that lawn chair looking out at our audience and just even saying thank you. I felt I was saying thank you, Bloomsburg.
Communities are hard, you know. It's hard to live together. It's hard to live together close. And we need to be reminded that it's worth it. We need to be reminded that that difficulty is worth it. And there is going to be crime, and there is going to be abuse, and there is going to be racism. And there are going to be moments when we're feeling lost and despondent. But the answer to that is in each other's eyes. And it's in each other's voices. And it's paying attention and listening. And if we can do that, we will be surprised that even in somebody that you know, politically you might want to strangle, there's love and there's care and there's someone who you'd let coach your kid. And that's all part of being in a place.
That's citizenship.
Yeah.
Learning to live together.
Would you give us a sample of longer letters?
Well, you just did one, so I'll do this one.
Okay.
Yeah, this is from 1793. The Rights of Fish. Fish are a species of animals which ought to be exempt from our tyranny. They inhabit an element of their own. They encroach not on our rights, nor do they destroy our property. We have no claim on them for their food, nor can we have any prejudice at their situation. To see a harmless and inoffensive creature tortured and dragged from the bosom of its home, its companions, and its attachments, to feed the luxurious appetite of man, is a scene so inconsistent to a rational mind that it ought to be discountenanced with the whole force of precept and example. Besides, angling, though every day practiced on the banks of the Susquehanna, is an unmanly and ungenerous sport. To beguile to death under the semblance of giving sustenance is mean and treacherous and beneath the dignity of a man of noble and tender feelings. There are animals whose natural ferocity and destructive disposition require correction in death, but to see the harmless trout driven from one end of its habitation to the other in the most agonizing distress till spent and breathless he yields to his destiny and the savage arts of man. MS, the Sunbury and Northumberland Gazette, October 9th, 1793.
Laurie McCants and Gerard Stropnicki of the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble speaking with WVIA's Erica Funky about the place of theater in the community, as well as giving us a little taste of their performance, Letters to the Editor, to be presented at 7 p.m. Tuesday as part of the NPR event Going There. What does it mean to be a good citizen? It takes place at the Royal Theater at the University of Scranton. Tickets for the event can be obtained at nprevents.org as well as on our website, wvia.org. The host for the event is Michelle Martin, weekend host of NPR's All Things Considered. Michelle is looking forward to the event on Tuesday evening, so much so that she took some time this past week to speak with us about the Going There series and some of the things that she has taken away as host of the thought-provoking NPR series.
I know that NPR was very interested in, you know, finding ways to kind of connect more closely with members of our audience. I know that I certainly am interested in that. And I can tell you that the first event that we did, even though it didn't have the Going There label, was after the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, in the wake of the young man named Michael Brown, who was killed in an encounter with the police there in Ferguson. And I think, as many people will remember, that led to, you know, days of street protests, some of which turned violent. It was a very searing, very intense time for people who live there. And the member station in St. Louis asked me to come and help them host a community conversation that they wanted to have. And of course, I said yes. And that isn't exactly the genesis of it, but it actually turned out to be the beginning of it, because the model that we then employed of trying to find a way to get different people in a room together who might not otherwise be in the room together to talk about something important, not always obviously as serious and as life and death as that, but something important and something meaningful, and that something everybody understood was something that was worth talking about, that really became the template for what we've been doing in the ensuing the rest of the year and in the 2 years since then.
We work in a field that demands consistency. We do things at prescribed times, knowing for the most part what the end result is going to be. So why do you feel it was important to leave the console and venture into different communities around the country to have these conversations, to open up these dialogues?
You know, I love the way you ask that question, because, you know, you're right, is that so much of reporting is, you know, you're kind of wading into an area, and a lot of what we like about it, I'm betting this is true for you too, is not knowing what you're going to find out. But a lot of times things get so chewed over that you think you know everything that there is to know about it, but you really don't, because you have a limited amount of time. You have, you know, only certain people who are available when you're available and can meet your deadline, right? This is an opportunity to get people in a room together who aren't necessarily available at noon on a Tuesday, right? This is, you know, these are events that bring people together at a time when they can come out. They can come out in the evening. They can participate via social media. And also the fact that we take topics that are big topics that people have thought about, but they might not have had a chance to talk over with somebody else. You know, I think sometimes as reporters, we forget that, you know, because we live in the world of ideas, ideas is kind of what we do all day long. I think sometimes we forget that that's a luxury for a lot of people, to have a chance to stop and think about something big, something like, you know, where does our food come from? What are we doing with our water? Unless it's your job to think about those things, maybe you don't really have time or permission to think about those things. One of the things I kind of think that these events do is it gives people permission to take, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours out of their day to think about something important. And that's one of the things that I really like about it. Also, it gives people a chance to share their ideas who aren't always the ones who are being asked. Because a lot of times, obviously, in the news media, and this is not wrong that we do this, we often, you know, look for people who have a credential. We look for people who studied something. We look for people to, you know, who are have a title. And that's not wrong, but these aren't the only people who have something to offer. And so one of the things that I like about these events is that it gives people a chance to participate in a conversation who aren't always the people who get asked. And I'll also just go right there and say that I feel strongly about the fact that I think that we have brought people to the NPR experience who perhaps have not always been NPR people. I mean, to be honest, you know, I mean, we're obviously really grateful that in public media we have a very loyal audience. We have people who are really value what we do. But I feel like this has been an opportunity to bring people to the table who perhaps haven't been, you know, a part of the NPR experience, because I know for a fact that people have come up to us and said, gee, I haven't listened to your show, or I'm not really a big NPR person, but now that I've heard this, you know, I will be listening, you know, now, or I heard about this on Facebook, I heard about this through social media, and that's why I wanted to come. And now that I've heard it, I just think it's been a really great opportunity to get people together, both in a physical room and in a bigger room, kind of broadly defined, who have not perhaps had a chance to be together and to talk things over together.
What are some of the outstanding things you've heard from communities in this process of the Going There events? And what are some of the similarities and differences that you've seen?
I think one of the similarities is clearly that people would like to be heard and seen and understood. And I think that we have seen a lot of conversation about that over the course of this past election year. I think a lot of people have been discussing that in a way that perhaps we had not been before, or at least not recently, about how important it is for people to feel that they're being included in conversations that affect their lives. So that is one key thing. One of the things also that has really struck me is that, you know, I'm always worried. I have to be honest. Some of it's just me. I'm always worried. It's like, anybody going to really show up? You know, because, you know, I mean, I'm like that no matter what it is. You know, I mean, if it was my birthday party, I'd be like, oh, is anybody going to show up? But people do show up, and they do show up. I know there's a lot of conversation these days about the way social media has changed our lives, the way technology has changed our lives. Are people still really willing to be together, or are they, you know, does looking at your screen kind of substitute for real connection? One of the things that I've seen is that people really do have a desire for real connection. One of the things that's been fascinating to me is that, you know, we have generally had a reception after every event. I can't think of one where we didn't. We've had some kind of get together after every event where everybody who comes out is invited. People all come and they all stay. They all stay. We have never had an event, even the tense ones, even the ones that have been hard to put together, because we've had people say, I don't want to be on the panel with this person. I don't want to be on the panel with this. We really have had events like that where we've had guests that we wanted to bring in, or people have said, I don't want to be with that person, or I don't want to talk about this with these people. When people do get there, they stay. And there's something really meaningful to me about that. And I'm not even sure that I fully understand it myself yet, but I can tell you in the 3 years of doing this that people have a desire. Once they come out, they have a desire to connect in a real way. And I think that's really fascinating. One of the things at our last event that was fascinating was about immigration and the border. We called it Beyond Borders in San Diego. And there were people from very different political perspectives, as you might imagine, as a part of this conversation. Intentionally, obviously, because that's the business we're in. We're in the business of bringing different perspectives together and giving them a platform to share their ideas with me and with each other. And one of the things that was fascinating to me was to see people with very different points of view huddled up after the event talking with each other. That was very exciting to me. And, you know, I was tempted to go over and eavesdrop, but I decided not to, because I'm hoping that in part what happens at these events is that they spur future conversations in these communities. I mean, if you can get people on each other's contacts list who have not been before, I cannot help but think that that's important.
And we know now it's ironic that we are more connected now more than ever before with social media, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, many other platforms. But there seems to be still this divide in the country that I think these conversations are going to be the beginning of some healing that we're going to be looking at, hopefully, in the coming years, because you have to start somewhere.
You do have to start somewhere. And I kind of feel that I think that I adhere to the notion that we can only be responsible for our process, and we can only have integrity around our process, and we can't take responsibility for the outcome because that's beyond our hands. But I feel really good about our process. I mean, we put a lot of effort into the reporting in advance. Our team, I do have to give credit to our team. This is very much a labor of love for the people who work on our team. And they work very hard to thoroughly report out the community and to try to find the voices of people who will add value, who will not just add value on their own, but who will be good guests and be respectful and will adhere to our concept of kind of civil dialogue. But what I will say is that I've heard people increasingly in recent months talk about the importance of people getting out of their silos. And one of the things that I see this is happening here, you know, that people are willing to sit and take the stage with people who have very different views, and they are willing to engage in respectful dialogue. And it's not always easy, and it's not always, you know, fun for everybody. You know, sometimes people are hearing things that are not comfortable always for them to hear, but they're doing it. And what, you know, what happens when you do that is you realize it can be done. It can be done. And I feel really good about the fact that we have had 3 years worth of experience of showing it can be done. And I feel that that in itself is a contribution, because people can say, oh, well, I can't talk to that person. Well, if you were there, if you were part of that conversation, if you were one of the 300 or 400 people who was present that day, if you were one of the, you know, however many thousands of people who participated via social media, then guess what? You know that, yes, you can. You can talk to that person, and that person can talk with you. And I feel like there has to be some value in that. There just has to be.
Michelle Martin, weekend host of All Things Considered and host of the NPR series Going There, What Does It Mean to Be a Good Citizen?, speaking with us about the event to be presented at 7 p.m. Tuesday at the Royal Theater at the University of Scranton. Tickets are still available and can be easily obtained online at nprevents.org. There's also an easy link on our website, wvia.org. During these last few weeks, we featured many stories of civic engagement in our listening area from a number of different organizations in anticipation of the event Tuesday evening. We hope that you plan to join us for an evening of conversation and performance to ask, what does it mean to be a good citizen? It's a live video stream panel discussion featuring nationally known commentators, as well as regional residents with local stories of civic engagement and good citizenship. The host is Michelle Martin, weekend host of All Things Considered. She's been a journalist for more than 25 years at The Washington Post and Wall Street Journal, and a regular panelist on Washington Week and Now with Bill Moyers for PBS. Now at NPR, in addition to anchoring weekend All Things Considered, Michelle Martin hosts the NPR event series Going There, traveling across the country to engage Americans in important conversations about critical issues. You are invited to join the conversation at 7 p.m. Tuesday. Tickets are available online at nprevents.org. There's also a very easy link on our website, wvia.org. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you at 7 p.m. Tuesday evening for NPR Going There, What It Means to Be a Good Citizen. For WVIA, I'm Paul Lazar.